The Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. Whatever stage your business is at, there's always time to imagine sustainable, positive change. AIB, for the life you're after.
Well, our first guest was a very familiar face on our TV screens in the early 2000s. Trini Woodall became a household name with her TV show What Not to Wear, alongside Susanna Constantine. The two poked and prodded thousands of people, mostly women, showing them how to dress and feel better about themselves. But after the TV cameras left and a hugely traumatic period in her personal life, Trini, in her early 50s, took the bold step of launching an online cosmetics and skincare business, selling almost everything she owned to help fund it. And it has certainly paid off. Trini Woodall, you're very welcome to the programme. Trini, lots of people will know quite a bit about you from your career, but something I noticed, you started off very young in boarding school. You were only six when you went to boarding school. Was that tough?
It was like six and a half. It was sort of what I knew to be the way that my parents sent their kids to school. So I didn't know any other way. And I think toughness is always when you have a measurement of an alternative. And I didn't really have that measurement. So as a result of that, I felt I didn't necessarily have the most intimate relationship with my parents because I only saw them about 6 months of the year for many years of my life. So that's probably more what it made me, it made the outcome.
Did you take something from that? Because if you found maybe, it was difficult, but you had to adapt to it as well.
What did I take from it that was positive? Absolutely jack shit, nothing. It was not the most pleasant experience. And I felt quite lonely. My sister was 4 years older and I didn't see her much. It was a very cruel school. And my sister ran away three times before my parents realized maybe we shouldn't be there.
And what were you like as a teenager? Would you say you were shy, the opposite of shy?
I'd say 13, I was really shy, found it quite, sort of 11, and I know it's pre-teenager, but I went to this other school at 11, thinking, let me try and make some friends. I found it difficult to make friends. I finally made friends. And then I was deemed to be, and probably was at the time, academically very stupid. And so I stayed down a year. And when you're in that kind of environment, staying down here means all those girls that you thought were your friends just, you don't chat to the girls in the year below. So I then had to start all over again. So I'd say the first years I found really difficult. And then the change for me came when I went with my parents to South Africa. And my parents met these very nice people who had a family, and one of the boys was lovely, and we started a little flirtation. Literally, we didn't even kiss, but it was sort of, he wrote me notes at school, and because I had a boy writing me notes, this is a very old-fashioned school, I was suddenly popular. And I came, I sort of found my way. And I'd also got into the reputation of because I lived out of England, I had access to places like Benetton, which at the time did the only colour on the high street. My parents would buy everything otherwise and everyone else's parents from Marks and Spencer's. So Benetton was this exotic, sophisticated European brand. And I would bring things back and make over my girlfriends and, make our shirts shorter and pin. I used to pierce girls' earrings with antifreeze. So I had a sort of a place and a reason, and it actually gave me my self-worth.
But it's funny the way you talk about meeting the boy, because the question I was going to ask you was, whether you were shy or not at that time, you come across as being uber confident, so confident. Were you confident back then, or maybe meeting this guy, all of a sudden the confidence flowed from there?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't confident back then. And then I also took drugs until I was 26. So that was definitely hiding behind something. And trying to discover, who I wanted to be and not really knowing yourself. So I think my life began again when I went to rehab for a year and I was 26. All my friends had been through unis on their second job, probably with somebody that they might be engaged to in 3 years' time. And I felt like an 18-year-old beginning my life again. But that was probably the biggest turnaround for me, because that's when, instead of that sort of bravado, which I think can be in our teens and early 20s, I'd been through quite a lot by then. So by 27, I was sort of, I want to have a fresh start. And I was given a fresh start.
So were you a bit wild during those years?
If you met me, you probably, how I felt inside and what you met would probably be two different people. Because you probably think I was quite confident and popular and was sort of, had fun, but also weirdly called frigid by boys. And then on the other hand, inside, I was slightly quivering and shy. So I was that kind of teenager and person in my early 20s.
So when it came to the world of media and TV, you started writing a column with Susanna and then the TV show.
Yeah. But then I was 30, Richard, you know. So I spent 4 years doing, you know, I was a secretary to somebody and then I worked in a PR business and I just slowly grew my confidence again. And then I sort of thought, I don't enjoy any of these things I'm doing, but I love when girls come to my house and I make them over and I give them fresh hair and makeup and give them a skincare routine. I felt purposeful. I felt needed. And at 30, I thought, how can I make this my career? I sort of actually took a very proactive step of, I don't want to wake up every day and slave my way into a job. How can I do something I love, but also pay the rent?
And how did you get a break into the column or TV? It's not easy to do.
We got a break because Susanna was writing about cricket for the Telegraph, mainly because she was going out with Imran Khan at the time, now the locked up president of Pakistan, but at that time, a very sexy Pakistani cricket player. And so she had an in. She was writing for it. There was a lovely journalist called Eric Bailey, and he was the sports editor. And then he moved and was given the weekend section of the Telegraph. And he thought, I know what I'll do. Fashion and cars. So he called up Susanna and he said, can you move from Imran and cricket to fashion and cars? I'd met Susanna by this stage and given her the idea for the column. So she said to me, can I sort of knit your idea and pitch it? And I went, no, you damn well can't, but we could pitch it together. We convinced Eric, let's do this column and let's actually do what's great and what's not great, you know. So that was why it was called What Not to Wear. And it was actually probably the first time that it was not a fashion column. It was a how to get dressed as a woman with your body shape and your budget column, if I made it very pedestrian in all it encompassed. But there wasn't really that around. So that's how probably then through a few years it became a show.
And it took off enormously and at its peak. I mean, the show was successful all around the world. The two of you became so well known. But even going back to a few years earlier when you weren't sure what you were doing and you were taking drugs and you were thinking about doing all that. I mean, was that all gone after rehab, or did you sort of slide back into it and it needed another go at it?
No, I haven't touched cocaine for 35 years. Yeah, I had a very, when that happened, Richard, in that first year of recovery, four of my best friends died from addiction. And I think you need things that really cement your determination to realise what you should and shouldn't be doing with your future. And I think that did for me. So I knew I would never, ever touch a drug again. But a day at a time is what you say in recovery. But I just knew that that would be the case. And I haven't.
And when the show was at its peak, what was life like for the two of you?
When I look at it, it's, you know, lots of people feel maybe it happened quickly, but it happened probably over about 10 years. You know, we did a show on BBC Two and then it went to BBC One. The next year, we'd done one book before we did TV, which sold 13,000 copies. The next book after TV sold 1 million copies. And then we did a book every year. And because then that became the norm, Susanna and I would do a show and we'd write a book. You get in this flow, and then every year you must have this as a journalist. In August, you think, will my contract be renewed? Will I get the show again? Will we do a book deal again? You know, and that was my life for about 10 years. And so you're not sitting back thinking, goodness, how successful am I?
So in a way, I mean, you'd made it, but you're never allowed to think or believe that you've made it because you can't be sure.
I think there's a fundamental difference in what I do now compared to that time in my life. And the biggest differences are that I'm in control of my destiny now. I run a business. I'm the CEO. There's 320 people in the business. I had to learn to be a CEO. I built a business up over 8 years. It is a successful business. You know, I feel sometimes embarrassed to say that, Richard, but, you know, it's like one of the fastest growing beauty startups in Europe was always how it's described.
Well, it's undeniable. It's been valued by one of the newspapers.
We never talk
anyway,
valuation.
£180 million.
No, we don't talk valuation.
That's not your number, but that's a number somebody put out. It is tremendously successful. But what really made you decide that you wanted to go for it? Because the TV show had come to an end. And were you in a sort of an in-between of a what do I do now?
Well, I'd always been an entrepreneur. I'd done a business when I was 16, selling hair bows, getting them made, getting little brooches from Portobello Market and selling them to little shops and then to Harvey Nichols and then taking them to New York. And then at 23, I started a sock business because I thought every man loses one sock in the washing machine, never comes back to him. Let me go on to trading floors. And I'd worked for a moment in the city and have lovely girls go in with baskets of socks, which went very well for 6 months until the socks I got from Eastern Europe shrunk and bled in the wash. But I sort of learnt lots of, like in that, I learnt about supply chain. And then a few years later, before I did What Not to Wear as a show, we did an online business in 99, but it was before e-com. It was before the ability to do commerce. So it was just a platform. But to me, I was fascinated from 99 about the concept of personalization and the internet. I loved it. I persuaded Susanna we should start a business. It was my sort of passion, and she was having a baby, but saying, I'll come along for the ride, and we did it together. But I always knew that I felt more driven, probably, and ambitious than Susanna in being a businesswoman. And Susanna is a very chilled, let's have a good life woman. So, you know, that's probably why we were very good together and we were a yin and a yang.
Tell me about getting the business started. Did you have the money for a start?
I had, when I started it, I had bought a house 2 years before at the sort of highest of my salary. And then in those 2 years, my salary went way down. So I was living in a house where the mortgage was really testing for me to pay. And it was that sort of dream house, Richard. I was 50 and I felt, you know, I've worked really hard, so I'm going to buy a house I really want to have.
But this was a house in Notting Hill.
Yeah, but I had a big mortgage on it, and you can't start a business with a lot of debt because it does not allow you to really put everything into that business. So I knew I would have to, first of all, get startup money. So I sold 80% of my clothes. I went on something called Emily's List, and I knew I was going to rent the house out, so I sort of didn't care who came in the house. I had 1,000 women in 3 days.
What's that? Difficult to decide to sell them, because you must have had a hell of a collection.
I did, but it's, things are very difficult to let go of unless you see something else on the horizon that feels more important. And I think I had that moment. So, you know, to me, the most important thing had been to have the dream home and to feel that sense of, I've worked really hard. Look, this is what I have to show for it. But then as my earlier career faded, I realized, ultimately, I think what I'd always wanted to be was an entrepreneur and grow a business properly. And I'd had 2 failed businesses. I'd had a successful career, but not as an entrepreneur.
And once you started it, I would imagine you really, really did not want it to fail. And that's part of, you know, you would do whatever was necessary to see it through.
You do. And there's moments when you don't know what the outcome's going to be. You know, at the very beginning, I bootstrapped and I rented out my house, and then I got a very small little cottage in Fulham, and then I started the business there. And then I realised I had to sell my house. And certain things happened in my personal life which made me have to sell the house as well. And my ex-husband had died, and there were, you know, sometimes there is debt when somebody dies. And so I kind of just had to clear everything out.
You'd so much going for you in a lot of ways based on your experience and all the things you had done. But in other ways, like you were 50 starting a business, you were a single mum, you didn't have all of the money and had to sell your house in order to make it happen. That was tough.
I didn't sit around the sofa thinking this is tough. I think, you know, it's, one can easily look back and think, oh, those circumstances seem tough. But at the time, when Johnny had died and we were at the funeral, there was a couple and they sat me down and they said, Trini, maybe, you know, they knew I had this idea for the business because I'd had the idea first and before Johnny died. And they said, maybe you need to just think, should you just get a job? Should you just get a regular salary? Maybe this is not the time for Lila to have that moment of insecurity or your feeling, where's the next penny coming from?
And what age was she at that stage?
She was 11. And then 2 weeks later, we had a memorial. Why we had them so close together, I don't know, but we did. And at the memorial, I went up to them and I said, I thought a lot about what you said, but I know if I don't do this, I won't be, there will be a part of me that will regret not doing it. And as a result of that regret, I know that I won't be the mother that I want to be for Lila. And it's a real challenge. And when people talk a lot, Richard, about the work-life balance, I don't look at life as a work-life balance. And maybe that's because I'm an entrepreneur and not employed. But I look at it as when I'm in work mode, I'm in work mode. You know, if Lila calls me up and has a drama, I'm there. But otherwise, I'll say, Lila, I'm working. Do you need me now or not? And then when I'm not in work mode, I'm her mum.
And she must have been going through a really tough time at that age. She'd lost her dad.
Mm-hmm. She was going through a tough time. But I think things like that come out later in children. I think there's a resilience in a child of that age where, you know, I remember it at his funeral in the basement of the church, Lila running around and laughing with her friends. And I remember thinking at the time, wow, how quickly kids can go from pain to, you know, just being immune to something. You know, it's always in there, Richard, but there's times in which things are ready to come out in life, I believe. And for her, that happened when she left school at 18. And she had a wobble and we did some, you know, it's called EMDR. It's a tapping. It really helps if somebody has gone through some trauma. And she's now at university in Madrid, profoundly happy. I mean, like, I couldn't wish for a happy child. In fact, this January, I always set an intention in January. And my intention was to be more Lila because she always looks at the positive for the negative. You know, in work, I'm always looking, oh, are the figures where I want them to be? Oh, is this person I've just hired, is that the right decision? Let me see how they are. You know, I'm always looking at what is it that we need to improve or where do we have a hole or where should we be next? How quickly do I feel we should be getting there? With Lila, she always thinks of the positive first. It's unreal and it's a part of her age. I don't know if you have children, but there is a thing, the younger you are, you have less challenges perhaps in life. But she lives in the light. She could live in the darkness and she lives in the bloody light.
And, well, it's fantastic to hear that she is so positive and so happy as well. And when you started the business, Trini, you would have needed to get investment and do pitches and all of that. Mm-hmm. I would have thought that Trini Woodall could pitch anything to anybody. You could sell anything to anybody. It would be a piece of cake for you.
So not the truth. Yeah. I mean, it was really challenging. I made a list of about 250 venture capitalists and I went to see them. And there's two elements to pitching. One is how you tell your story, how you have your figures, your P&L, your projections, knowing all your figures. The other is the mood of the room and what they want to invest in. So in the many rejections I had, I would send an email afterwards and I'd say, can you just tell me why you said no? And some would just want to send something back incredibly trite, like it wasn't for the fund, you know, it wasn't in the premise of what the fund was investing in. And then I thought,
which is a kind of, it's not you, it's me, isn't it?
Well, it's sort of a little bit. It was one of a few things. One was they vaguely knew the name, so they thought, why not take a meeting with her? But actually, they had no intention of investing. So when people say to you, did it help that people slightly knew you? I go, yes, but no. The other element was what I had to learn. So people might say, some people would say to me, love what you're doing, but if you want to do this sort of woman of a certain attitude, and they wanted me to put an age bracket, and I said, it's an attitude, not an age. That's very difficult to understand when you're looking at age demographics. But I think there's a time by which a woman becomes a grown-up. She could be 28 or 60, and she thinks, I need to now do what's best for me.
Did you feel there was ageism going on in those rejections of the pitch that you were making?
There was, but it's just like, poor them. You know, frankly, poor them, they didn't invest, actually, because there was sort of, will you have the energy to run a business? I thought, you're kidding me, right? But anyway, there was a bit of that from sort of, you know, tech bros.
You might have reached for them at that stage.
And I thought those tech bros who are 28, I'm thinking, you probably need some really nice kind of nootropics to keep you going, darling, but I just to energy. So I did get things, but I think everyone does. But I think being a woman, you know, there is a stat, Richard, which you all know, that 98% of venture capital goes to men and 2% to women. It's a stat which is the only thing worse, I would say, is the priesthood in terms of those percentages. But what it means is that there is still an inherent challenge for women to fundraise. And so I had to step into what did I need to do and how I told my story? Because I knew my figures. I knew, you know, I based a lot of men will think I'll get 40% right and I can talk it like it's 100% right. But as a woman, I probably think I need 99% right. I need to know every figure. I need to know where I got it from. I need to know how I've analysed how we will grow. So for some people, my growth was not fast enough in the projection of what I felt I wanted to do, because I wanted to build a business on retention more than acquisition. And at the trend in the market with the D2C business, it was all about having new customer growth and small retention. And I just thought that is not a long-term business. So I felt I wanted to do sort of 60% retention, 40% acquisition. And they were like, no. So they rejected it on that basis.
There are hundreds of employees in the company now. How would you describe your management or leadership style? Because you have a persona that is quite direct, sometimes mm-hmm. blunt when you mm-hmm. need to be. Is that how it works?
I think you decide what kind of CEO you want to be. You can be what I call a servant CEO. You can be a very ruthless CEO. You can be many different types. I had never learnt to be a CEO, Richard. I'd done my online business. We had 60 people when I had the business for 2 years and it folded after 2 years. So I learnt a lot about how I built Trinity London. I didn't build it with a whole load of middle range executives around me who would decide the direction of the business. I thought, I know I want to set the direction, the intention of the business, the integrity of it, the atmosphere within the business. And then I built the team up. So now we're 8 years in and we have an executive team and I have some incredibly good people. I have from really great businesses I respect, admire in different roles. And it's 86% female, that executive team. And I do a mixture. I think early as a CEO, I have a CEO coach from Silicon Valley. He's fantastic. But he's quite spiritual as well. And I remember he described to me about 4 years ago, Trini, you're like a dragon at New Year in Chinese New Year. You're on the head of the dragon and your team are in the body of the dragon. And you're looking and you're because I always think of a lot of different ideas, all right? And probably 70% will land and 30% are just crap. But I'm quite good at ideas. And
are you okay about being told that that percentage are crap by somebody in the organization?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I am. But this is how we got there. I'm just explaining the road of getting there and I had to learn it. So I'm in the head of the dragon and I'm turning because I think that's such a great idea. Let's do this. And I feel intuitively this is really good. And then that team is trotting behind me in the body of the dragon, you know, back and forth. So as I turn my head, I'm only turning it a bit, but my God, the journey for them is huge. So what I had to realize is if my head is at 1,000 miles an hour, not that I need to slow down for my team because that insults them, but I need to be really like take one step in front of another step. And I need to not always tell them what to do. I need to listen to their ideas. I do want them to think, you know, the ultimate thing that I say to anyone I hire in a senior role is I want to be at a stage in our relationship where I'm sitting around the room and you've come up with the idea before I have. And it's an idea I haven't thought of. And I think, wow. And that, Richard, is the most exciting. That's when you know you have that A-star team member because they're thinking outside the box. They're thinking more cleverly than you're thinking. And you're thinking, wow, this is brilliant.
You have an Irish makeup artist, John Corcoran, yes. Bonzo yes. Boy.
I love that you know Bonzo Boy. That's
well,
fantastic.
I can't say I
You've
know
You've really
him,
done your research, Richard.
I know of him. And you have a head of product development, a woman called Claire Byrne, who I think is Irish as well.
Yeah, from Dublin, yeah.
So you're surrounding yourself with Irish people, are you, Trini?
I got to say, I've got strong Irish influence in my life, yes. And so I see all those elements of the Irish. And I learned a few expletives from them.
Colloquial too. Phrases.
A colloquial phrase, let's call it that. But I do, I understand, I think, probably the character of the Irish through having those very, you know, Claire has been our chief innovation officer for over 5 years. And John has been with us the same amount of time. So, yes, I'd say I have a strong Irish influence.
Bonzo Boy sounds like he has a great job travelling around doing the makeup and teaching you colloquial Irish phrases.
Yeah, he also works really hard and teaches the team and does artistry and works in new product development. And we look at colour progression. And so he has he's not just doing my makeup, no.
Can you think of any of those Irish phrases off the top of your head, no?
What the crack? What's the crack or whatever? What's the one? What's the crack? Give me the crack.
That gets you in. No, tell me
the proper, Richard, tell me the proper way to say it.
No, that's it. What's the crack?
What's a crack?
We had good but crack, then I had to have this kind of crack.
I don't. What's a crack? There's a breathlessness to it that John would do.
Right.
What's the crack?
You've got that off well.
Okay.
What about the future, Trini? The business has grown. Surely you must have been approached at different times about selling it. Do you think you would sell it?
I think that I've got a lot still to do. You know, we started skincare 4 years ago, and that's now 50% of my revenue. So that's growing quite quickly. We're in America. It's 10% of our business. Next year, I want to double that. So there's a lot of work to be done in the US. We've had a pop-up in New York. We just did a pop-up now in Boston. Mainly, everything is online there. So I want to look at how does that develop. Europe is a growing market for us now with AI. There's a lot of work I'm doing with AI in the business, and I love AI passionately, but in the way that you can have a consumer's journey be totally in their language. So I could be speaking to them in their language. They hit an ad which is in their language, and they then go on the website in their language. All those things were really challenging and expensive to do beforehand, and AI has accelerated that process. So within Meta, you can then, you know, change the language of things. And then when I built my localized German site, it took forever. It was 2,000 euros a month to maintain. But these things now are incredibly simple compared to what they were 2 or 3 years ago. So I think there is an excitement about looking at territories with the help of AI to accelerate the expansion of the business.
You've said, Trini, that you want to work until you're 80.
Yeah.
Why?
Actually, I say that I didn't mean it. I want to work till I'm 100. Because I want to work until I die, actually. Because I don't, for me personally, I want to feel the stimulation of life at the core of life. And I think I had two parents, Richard. My mum had Alzheimer's and vascular dementia. My dad was very physically, he had diabetes and he was very physically incapacitated. And I think you do grow up with what you would love from your parents and what you reject from your parents. And it makes me feel like I bought a book the other day. It's a journal, an empty journal. And on the front of it, it says the next 50 years. So that's why I'm saying I might just work 10 years before I die.
You're planning ahead. You've also said that this decade is your happiest.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because each decade, if I 20s was confused and very insecure, 30s was learning to have a career, 40s was learning to be a mother, 50s was not worrying what people think about you, and 60s is knowing what you don't want.
You've done so much in your career, Trini. I suppose a final question. If you were brave enough to do something or do anything, what do you think it might be?
Oh, I'll tell you what I'd like to do. Okay, so if you think, like, what's my passion after this, in a way, is if I do really well on Trini London and I release some capital, I will start a fund and I will make sure that 98%, 2%, that I am partly responsible for the change in that. That's what I'd like to do.
Well, that sounds like a great goal. Trini Woodall, founder and chief executive of Trini London, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Richard.
And if you've been impacted by any issues raised in that interview, you can go to rte.ie/helplines for more information.